podcast listeners, you've listened to the podcast. Now you want the chance to come on the program yourself. So here it is. Do you remember those books, Choose Your Own Adventure, where you would pick where to go next and follow that story? Well, help us flesh out the VitBuckle Society complication session at the annual meeting in March 2020 by submitting your surgical videos of your complications in vitreoretinal surgery. These videos can be narrated or anonymous with the description to mklufas@gmail.com. That's mklufas@gmail.com. We all learn more from reviewing our mistakes as groups and with our colleagues, so this is a great learning opportunity. And two big things, the top five entries will be shown during the meeting and discussed by a panel discussion. But more importantly, if you're one of the top five entries, we'll invite you to come on the podcast for a one-on-one interview to discuss the case and learning points. The winning entry out of the five will then win a special VitBuckle Society buckle. So send your entries to mklufas@gmail.com. That's mklufas@gmail.com. Thank you.
Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, I had the chance to sit down with my colleague, Dr. Thomas Albini. We discussed many things, including his career entering retina and uveitis training, his thoughts on balancing a career with retina and uveitis, his perspectives as a founding member and past president of the VitBuckle Society, and we even delve a little bit into his love of the Buffalo Bills and what it means for his children's happiness. Remember that a list of financial disclosures can be found in the episode description. Also, there's a link in the episode description to visit the American Academy of Ophthalmology website and claim CME credit for this episode and other podcast episodes. I have the pleasure of sitting down now with my colleague and a friend, Dr. Thomas Albini. Dr. Albini is professor of ophthalmology here at the Bascom-Palmer Institute, where he's been for many years on the retina service and also practices uveitis. And he has other roles and former president of the VitBuckle Society and a president emeritus on the board. Founding member of VitBuckle Society and many other accolades and positions. Dr. Albini, thanks for your time.
Yeah, thanks for doing this. This will be fun.
It's going to be casual and fun. So I think you're an interesting guy, and I'm going to tell you why I think you're an interesting guy. Because I think you have a very varied set of interests. You have an interesting educational background, the things you studied in school. You're Croatian, which is great. Always cool. Croatians are cool. So tell
in
me,
vogue right now. Yeah.
Were you born in Croatia?
No, I was born in Austria, to make it even more complicated.
Okay.
But my parents are both Croatian. They went to university in Vienna, and that's where I was born.
Okay. And then
we made our pathway over from beautiful Vienna to even more beautiful Buffalo, New York.
Buffalo, New York. We're going to talk about your Bills fandom a little later.
Yeah.
That's tough. So let's talk about, how old were you when you moved to the U.S.?
Seven.
I mean, it's old enough for you to remember, the move and the transition.
I remember being in kindergarten, not being able to speak a word of English. And that lasted for months.
Really?
So, well, I don't know how many words I learned. I'm a slow learner. So I don't know what the rate was. But it was definitely a long process in terms of just sitting there. And I remember it not bothering me particularly. Mm-hmm. The kids were very nice, and I just kind of like hung out. But there was no verbal communication. Mm-hmm. And the teacher was speaking, and I could not understand anything she was saying. And that took, months. And then by the time I got into first grade, I spoke English, but my reading was really behind because I just didn't speak the language. So they tried to hold me back a year and have me repeat first grade. And my mother complained and made them push me forward, even though I didn't speak the language. And so it ultimately worked out. But it was a bit of a struggle for a while.
I mean, I'm assuming your parents didn't have family, in the area. They were the only people in their
family.
That's
right,
here.
Yeah.
I mean, that's different. I feel like when you grow up, and I grew up, parents are immigrants to Miami. It's not like we had cousins and relatives in the area. It's a little different growing up with school and with other kids, you just have a different experience, I guess. It's not a problem. It's not a bad thing. It's just like, it's a little different than your traditional American experience. So you could say the immigrant experience is maybe the traditional American experience.
Yeah. I mean, interestingly enough, apropos of that, I wound up going to a middle school and high school that was made up largely of immigrant community kids.
Oh, interesting.
Kids. And so in that way, it never felt that weird to me because there were a lot of other kids that were kind of in the same situation. It was a Catholic school in the area, but I think my father had found out about it because a lot of his friends at the university, he was at the medical school at SUNY Buffalo. A lot of his friends at the university sent their kids there, and so I wound up going there. And a lot of us had similar stories as being, you know, immigrants or just first generation U.S.
What did your dad do?
He was an immunologist, so microbiologist. He's completed a residency in general surgery in Austria. And as part of that that experience, they had like a year of research, and he did a year of immunology research, and then that wound up being his career. And he never went back to surgery.
And so you go to Princeton for your undergrad studies.
Yeah.
Not warmer, maybe a little bit warmer.
I thought it was tropical, actually. I always say I thought New Jersey was tropical compared to Buffalo, yeah.
So, and you studied history, right?
I did.
So what was your major?
It was technically history. It was in the history of science, whatever division, I guess, of the department. And then within that division, there was one professor, Gerald Giessen, who specialized in history of medicine.
Hmm.
And I really wound up working with him. As part of that experience, I wrote a thesis in history of medicine. And he was, you know, he was my mentor in that. So my thesis there was about Koch's postulates.
Oh, interesting.
And looking at why those postulates developed, and how well they were actually used. They're sort of ingrained as being like classic doctrine on how to prove that a pathogen causes a disease. But if you actually look at how many times they were actually successfully implemented, it's very few. Because there's few infections that really can meet where we have a good enough animal model to use them. So that's what the thesis was on. But one thing that I learned that I think really stuck with me from that research was looking at how scientific communities, and specifically the medical community, how truth is established and how it moves forward. And that it's not a simple linear progression.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you might naively think that when you come in, you'd kind of prove something and then that's definitely true. But that it's really more like 1,000 people all talking at once, and then you kind of see where the herd moves. And that was interesting anyway.
Well, one of the things, you know, we're jumping ahead a little bit, but one of the things we talked about with other guests, you know, Andrew Lamb wrote this book about ophthalmology. He wrote about different breakthroughs in ophthalmology. And the common thread seems to be that even ophthalmology, other fields of medicine, is you come up with an idea, and maybe it is correct, and something that we take for granted now.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, it's decried, it's ridiculed. It's not usually accepted right from the beginning, right? It's very rare that you come up with an idea, and everyone's like, you know what? I think you hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what we should be doing. That's what we shouldn't be doing. Usually, I think as doctors and maybe human beings, we stick to what we know. And so if someone comes in with an idea that now we look back and say, you know, Jonas Salk, vaccination, what a great idea.
Yeah.
It just takes time for acceptance. So like with your background in history and thinking about that, I mean, what do you think is kind of, how does that color kind of how you view absolute truths in medicine today, like in ophthalmology? I mean, do you think there are any absolute truths in medicine? Like, I feel like you can almost become a medical nihilist in a way, you know, where you kind of look at things and say, well, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, they were wrong about 80% of these things, right?
Yeah.
So what does that say about our knowledge today versus the future?
I think you have to be careful and look at what things really work. I mean, the one thing that it's taught me and that I've become a little bit of a cynic about is, for example, in uveitis and looking at immunology, there are so many predictions you can make because we have a finite set of truths from the that are kind of accepted in the basic science immunology world, and then try to translate those into clinical practice.
Mm-hmm.
And in uveitis, for example, we've been, you know, very disappointed when molecule after molecule that's targeted with a new and upcoming therapy doesn't actually work. And even though you could predict that they would work, or the converse, where a molecule like CTLA-4 that blocks co-stimulatory blockade on T cells that seems to make sense if you can get at the beginning of an inflammatory process, but maybe shouldn't make any sense in a chronic inflammatory process, that actually works in chronic inflammation. So sometimes the reality of the therapy doesn't really meet up with or jive with the basic science that we have.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, what it teaches us is that you really, you have to take everything with a grain of salt, and things change over time. But That being said, about being a nihilist, I'm not a nihilist. I mean, I think there are things that definitely work, and we see those in clinics. So the right. beauty of what we do is that we take science and then implement it. And it's the implementation that really matters, and you see whether it works or not when you do that.
So it sounds like, you know, your dad was a surgeon, immunology, you do your undergrad. At what point do you decide you want to be a physician? Then when do you decide you want to do ophthalmology? And again, you tied it into immunology with uveitis, but that's right. a very different field.
Yeah, it was an interesting path. So I think that when I was in college, I started off wanting to be a theoretical physicist. And mm-hmm. I remember people asking me why I wanted to do that. And unfortunately, I wasn't smart enough to have a real answer. My answer was just I liked it. And I liked physics and I liked math. And so I studied that. But when I got to Princeton, I realized that the guys who were doing theoretical physics, who were really like the standout guys, had a caliber of math ability that I did not have. And so I struggled along with it for a year, and I actually did reasonably well, considering, I mean, these were guys who were like, you know, had already done differential equations in high school. It was an interesting bunch of characters. One of them, I think, has recently won like the Field Prize in mathematics.
Oh, right.
So these, these turned out to be really successful guys, but and it was a small group, but I backed out, and then my mother, kind of practical as she was, kind of said, well, what are you going to do with physics anyway? And of course, there's a million answers, but I said, okay. She was like, why don't you be a doctor like your dad? And so I thought about it, and I did really appreciate the scientific aspects of what my dad was doing as a researcher. And when I thought about it more, I also had considered at that time maybe doing PhD physics, just going into, or sorry, PhD history. So I started doing physics, then I took a bunch of history courses, and I was like, wow, I'm really good at history. I was good at writing papers and at doing research. Started doing that, and then I thought I wanted something with more people interaction. I didn't want to be stuck in a library all the time, or I didn't want to be with test tubes and all that. And it was that daily contact with people and making changes in people's lives that really drove me towards medicine then.
It's funny that you say that, because I think many of us have reached crossroads. I think some people I brought on the program to say I wanted to be a doctor since I was a little kid. Yeah. And I think some people reach crossroads. You know, I almost did a PhD in history myself. So like it was the same sort of thing. It's just hard to project what you're going to be doing in 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 years. And I think the personal interaction you just don't get in some fields.
Yeah, I felt it was kind of lonely. Like, I looked at the guys that I thought were really great at writing history and the guys who wrote these you know, sometimes best-selling or at least known about history books that were out there. And I just thought of them, you know, sitting in a library reading all the time. And that was the problem. I liked reading. I liked being in the library. But I thought I would like things more if I was actually interacting.
So you go to Hopkins, med school.
Yeah.
When do you decide you want to be an ophthalmologist?
That was interesting. I had not thought about ophthalmology. I had some ideas of doing something surgical. You know, my dad was a surgeon. I guess that probably influenced me. I also thought I liked the practical nature of it, that you could see what you were doing and you could see the benefit that you're having immediately. So I liked all those things. I thought about orthopedics for a while. I didn't have a great experience in my surgical rotation at Hopkins. I wonder if I should be admitting this. But anyway, I don't think anybody's going to care anymore.
You're past the statute of limitations.
But,
hopefully.
But, and it was funny. Like, the thing that I thought was odd about it was some of the personalities. And you know, and it's funny. I think a lot of these things are kind of random. It depends on the chemistry of the people you're around when you do them. But my particular team had this funny dynamic where we had this fantastic guy who was the head of the team. He was doing cardiac surgery, and then there was a mid-level guy who was just a nasty guy, and he was so nasty to everybody around him, to the interns that were under him, to the head guy that was above, and I started to realize that kind of behavior, undercutting, like throwing people under the bus, like just making it more stressful of an experience than I really thought it had to be, that wasn't uncommon. You know, among surgeons. And so that got me thinking about it. And then the other thing was that by virtue of my dad, I started doing some research in an immunology lab. And so I worked in the lab of Fred Sanfilippo, who was studying transplantation rejection and chronic rejection. He was the chairman of the pathology department. I wound up spending a year in this lab because I really had a great experience there doing some basic science research. But as part of that, I was working with a woman who was a resident in general surgery. And she was going to go into cardiothoracic surgery, and she wanted to do cardiac transplants. And as it turns out, this woman is an ophthalmologist now. So some of the listeners may know her, but I'm not going to reveal who it is. But anyway, she was kind of a big deal. But she decided that she was not going to go into cardiothoracic surgery. And so in the middle of her research block, where I was helping her, she was doing cardiac transplants on monkeys, and I was watching the monkeys at night. That was my responsibility. But anyway, and that was kind of fun and interesting.
That should be the name of your autobiography one day.
Watching monkeys at night. But in any event, she decided she wasn't going to go back into surgery, and she switched into ophthalmology. Huh. I think she had a relative who was an ophthalmologist that talked her into it. And then that experience got me thinking about ophthalmology because we were talking a lot about it. There was also an ophthalmologist from Germany there that was studying corneal transplants. And he was huge on that ophthalmology was the only way to live. And that was the job that everybody should have. Everybody should be an ophthalmologist. So I started getting interested in it. And then I did one rotation at Willmar, and I did another rotation. I spent 2 months with Dick Green. I spent a month with Neil Miller.
And let's be clear. I mean, Wilmer is obviously still premier IF institute. It was a rich time too. Rich people there.
You couldn't have had a better experience. It was really great. The Bresslers were there. Susan Bressler was in charge of the medical school rotation at the time, and. So I remember having a very tough day in clinic with her. But I loved the approach. I loved the lectures. And I loved the scientific approach. And what I liked was the combination of, on the one hand, it was a surgical discipline. On the other hand, there was so much data. And everybody at Willmar that I met was so interested in science, which didn't carry over to some of the other fields, some of the other surgical fields that I was looking at. I like the personalities also. At one level, too, I thought that the ophthalmologists seemed happier and seemed like a more cohesive collegial group than the general surgeons, for example, that were throwing each other under the bus. So I think that was where I just felt like it really jived. And at the end, it was just kind of a subjective click. You know, I just felt like this is where I see myself, and I think I'm going to be happy doing this. And that's the way I went. But it's interesting because I think that it was pretty clear to me after my rotation with the Bresslers, but after listening to all the talks, on DRS and ETDRS and just how those trials were designed and what they showed and how they've impacted patient care, I fell in love with retina, and it seemed like that was the way I was going to go. It was retina. So I think I kind of knew that I was ultimately going to wind up in retina. But it wasn't until residency that I put the immunology background together with my interest in retina to wind up in.
And you went cross country, you went to LA.
Yep.
And you actually preceded a lot of Hopkins faculty who went from Hopkins in the retina department to USC either before or after that time.
That's right.
Which is interesting too. It was like a very big pipeline back and forth.
Yeah, that was interesting.
Gene DeWan, Mark Ryan
came over.
And Ryan before that, right? Wasn't it?
Ryan was, yeah. I mean, so Doheny was always a little bit of a Willmar of the
West.
There
was a connection there.
There was a connection. Well, I mean, Doheny was started by Steve Ryan, and he came almost directly out of being chief resident at Willmar. I think he had been there a couple of years as faculty, and then was recruited to be chairman and was the first full-time ophthalmologist at LA County, Doheny, and put that triad of USC and LA County and the Doheny Foundation together.
So LA County, you weren't busy at all.
LA County was
that
fantastic.
Old building is like a, I think it, I don't know if it still is, but they preserved it. I think no one uses it, but it was. I remember when I interviewed.
It was empty, but
they couldn't tear it down. It was
too much granite.
Yeah, maybe.
It's too expensive to rip it down. I mean, from what I understand. Plus, also, you would think that it is an impressive, beautiful building.
They designated it a historical site and kept it.
Yeah.
And then you worked at Narsingh Rao after that. Was that the next step?
Yeah, I met Narsingh Rao. I knew about Narsingh Rao even before I started at Doheny. I don't think I interviewed with him when I interviewed for residency, but I knew he was there, and I knew he was very interested in posterior segment disease. He'd done a lot of work in AIDS and AIDS complications, and uveitis, and of course in animal models of uveitis. And so I knew that he was there, and really he kind of blended all these interests that I had. I also really liked ocular pathology from my time with Dick Green when I was at Wilmer. So he was an eye pathologist who did immunology research that was interested in the posterior segment clinically. So you know, all of that kind of jived, and I wound up spending a year with him, and that was really, you know, well, obviously I wound up being a uveitis specialist, so
yeah.
I'm still happily doing that in spite of all the many reasons why uveitis does make you want to tear your hair out, or a lot of people tear their hair out, but I do still love it, and so I definitely got that from being with him.
You go to Baylor.
Yeah.
BBS is sort of founded there, right? I mean, maybe the seeds are starting.
I never thought of it.
The seeds, right? Yeah. Your co-fellows, Ross Locke and Paul.
Yeah.
Your residents, Jorge Fortun.
Yeah.
I mean, that's three of the founding members. Steve Yeh is there too.
Yeah.
So, like, there's a lot of people, you know, all around the same generation who have gone on to great things. And let's talk about BBS. I think you have to tie it in a little bit to your fellowship attending transition. I mean, you came here.
Yeah.
After fellowship,
yeah.
We'll talk about that. But
yeah.
I think we should talk a little bit about BBS, because I think it's one of the biggest impacts you and that group of people have made is this organization. So how did it come out? Why did you guys do it? How was it received by your mentors and other people in the field?
Yeah. I think, how it came out is easy, because I remember the moment that we had the idea to do it. I don't think anybody, including myself, took it seriously or thought it was really going to go anywhere. But we were sitting around at a bar during Fellows Forum in Chicago.
The annual thing in January.
The annual thing, which was great. It must have been the first night of it. And Paul Glebe, who's a rep with B&L Surgical, was there. And I think what it was that I was with some fellows from Wills, I remember, and they were telling me that when they have Macoff retinal detachments and they do a vit buckle, that they sometimes, if they try to drain through the peripheral break, and if they leave a puddle of fluid over the macula, it doesn't bother them, because if you fill the eye up with gas the next day, it's going to be gone. I don't know if this is still a practice pattern they have at Wills, or this was some particular, you know, one of the attendings 15 years ago that was doing this or whatever, but anyway, I thought that was really cool, and because it made sense to me conceptually that I'd never considered it. Like, everybody I operated with wanted everything perfectly dry, you know, by the end. In fact, to the point of using perfluorocarbon, which is what Ross and I were always arguing about. He loved PFO at the time. I didn't. So it was like drainage retinotomy versus PFO. You know, people still argue about
this. And
then
this person comes in, throws a third option on the table, right? And then you're like, oh. Derek Kunimoto was part of that group.
I think Derek was there.
Yeah.
And, you know, probably Paul Chan and Charlie Mango and Ross and I think that was the group of us that was there that night. And then I just thought, you know, this is really cool. Like, we really need to talk about this kind of stuff, because this is not paper worthy. I mean, nobody's going to publish this thing, or, you know, or it's unlikely anyway, but wouldn't it be great if we had a forum where we could get together and talk about surgery? And this was in 2006, I think. So I think at that point, there really weren't like surgical video conferences the way there are now. And Derek had just edited for Wills, had edited like a surgical video. I think it was all of ophthalmology, not just retina, but a surgical video compendium that had, you know, a big collection of videos. I don't remember if it was online or how it worked, but he had done that. And I was talking to him, and I was like, we should do a video meeting. And that was kind of where it started. And then Paul Glebe said, hey, you guys should do something like Club Vit. He was like, those guys started, you know, Club Vit, and this is like the next generation. You can be the young Club Vit. And that's where, you know, in my amazing humor, I said, well, why don't we call it Club Vit Buckle? And then then it went, because we had been talking about Vit Buckle. So, and then it went to Vit Buckle Society, and that was it. So I think we all had said it that night. I was like, let's start this video conference thing. But like, I think nobody really
expected
remembered
it, to
it or expected
right.
it to
yeah,
happen.
Right.
And then the subsequent year, or maybe later that year, probably in late 2000, because that was January of 2006. So in the summer to fall of 2006 was the ASRS meeting mm-hmm. in, what's it called, in California, in
San Francisco.
The desert.
Oh, Palm Springs.
Palm Springs.
Yeah.
And I had gotten a BNL through Paul Gleeby and some other folks I knew there to sponsor a dinner. It was a very humble, you know, small dinner for 15 people. And we had a projector that I think I brought from Baskin Palmer. I may have even carried the screen. I'm not sure. But anyway, but from Baskin Palmer all the way out there. And we just showed surgical cases. And Tim Murray was there. Remember, he was just a great commenter on all the cases. Nina was there. And a lot of that group, John Kitchens was there, and Andrew Moshvegi. And a lot of that group that formed the VBS board and so forth was there that night. And it was just a lot of fun. And it generated a lot of interest. One little anecdote I can share is that I was literally handing out flyers to get people to come to this thing.
At the meeting,
as people were walking out of the lecture hall, and Harry Flynn walked up to me and he said, "Hey, what are you doing?" And I'm like, "Oh, we're starting this new young guy retina thing where we're just going to show surgical videos and stuff. You want to come?" And he goes, no, I'd love to." He goes, "But I've got a meeting with the old guys. We're meeting by the urinals. We're calling it the BPH Club."
Dr. Flynn's the best.
Yeah, that was pretty funny. So anyway, it worked out. And then, the interest in it just kept growing. We did it again at the second ASRS meeting. And then I think there was a combined meeting of the ASRS, Macular Society, Retina Society in New York. We did the third one. By the third one, we had about 60 to 80 people, I forget exactly, interested in coming.
Oh, wow.
And that was when Alcon started getting interested in it. And so we started having people ask us if they could support us, as opposed to us begging BNL to support us in the beginning. And that started turning the tide. And then a couple years later, it got to be so popular. We started doing, I think one year we had, I forget if it was 2010 or 2011. We had four meetings. We did one at Arvo. We did one mm-hmm. at Angiogenesis, and the attendance was high at all of them. And so then we went and looked into the concept of doing a standalone meeting. And I didn't think we'd get 100 people to come, but I think we got 120 at our first meeting. And now we're up to 200 something, every year.
And Ross is the president, but you obviously were there since inception. So I think it's interesting because I think there's branch points anytime you have an idea like that, right? So you have the idea, you're just talking about it.
Yeah.
It takes a certain activation energy to have the dinner.
Right.
Then you have the dinner.
Right.
And then it takes a certain activation energy to say, well, now we want to actually do a meeting because it's a lot more work, right?
Right.
Than just doing a dinner.
And risk. I mean, we thought we could fail, that we were, at some point, we were personally liable for some of this stuff.
Right. So, but there's risk. There's time. Time is money. Yeah. But at each point, you're making a decision. Is it worth doing this? Do we want to take on the greater complexity? And is this what we want our organization to be about? Right. Because you're going up one level every time.
Yeah.
And I think it's really interesting. It's fascinating because BBS continues to grow. Right. Yeah. And you aren't speaking for the whole group. You're just speaking from your perspective. Uh-huh. But what's the end point? And I'm gonna give you a second
concept. An end point to BBS?
But everything...
That's impossible.
It's but the reason I say this is because I talked to Jerry Bovino and I talked to Kirk Pacco. Mm-hmm. And they were both there for the start of ASRS mm-hmm. back when it was the Vitreous Society.
Yeah.
And that was formed as a reaction to Macular Society, right? They weren't allowed to be in the room. They made their own meeting to be inclusive to all.
Right.
And now ASRS is this huge, sprawling organization that does so many great things, but it's a huge organization. Mm. It's a behemoth, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now VBBS is the small, if you had to compare the difference between a cruise ship and a jet mm-hmm. ski, right? There's advantages to being smaller and there's disadvantages to being smaller. Mm-hmm. But one of the advantages is you can make rapid fire decisions. You can do things more innovative fashion. You're not taking as much risk for a huge organization when you make decisions. Right. But now VBS is growing.
Right.
And so the question is at what point do you say, how do we keep ourselves as a young meeting,
right?
That's a challenge because ASRS is no longer the young guys who couldn't get into Macular Society.
Yeah.
It's a bigger organization. It's not an older meeting, but it's not a younger meeting.
Yeah.
It's kind of the guys who just, it's an established organization. So like, so what do you think about
this? Well, I'll say a couple things about that question. So I think, first of all, what is it that I, why do I do, why did I do? Because now I'm kind of backing out a little bit, and that gets into the second part of your question. But why am I so passionate about BBS? Well, what I liked about BBS was that, I hoped that it would be very collegial, but that that collegiality would allow really frank discussions, a lot of back and forth. As you know, I wanted it to be a discussion more than a meeting. So, and I think we're keeping to that. I mean, now it's in your hands, you know. But my original thought was to try to keep it like the original meeting where somebody showed a video and then there was a discussion, and that discussion might go in, you know, who knows in which direction depending on who's sitting at the table, and so. I would like the meeting to be, or my thought was that the meeting could be like that. And I think we still stick to that. I think we're still trying to encourage as much discussion so that if somebody says something that's obviously not true, that somebody else in the audience would feel comfortable calling them out about it. Or if they just haven't considered another element or another data point or, you know, I mean, if you have an entire discussion about treating diabetic retinopathy and you don't mention PRP laser, that's a little, you know, it just doesn't reflect the reality on the ground. Discussion, and so somebody can say that, even though maybe it'll annoy some guy at Regeneron, or maybe it'll annoy the speaker in some way. But the important thing is that everybody respects everybody else that's in the room, and that kind of comment and criticism can be taken. That's why I liked, I know we're not doing it anymore, and I think it's good that we move on to other things, but for a number of years at VBS, we had the fact check booth, which was Harry Flynn's idea, and that was a great idea, and he would just outright, when he saw something that he thought wasn't really supported by the data, he would put up the paper that would, you know, be in often really standing in sharp contradistinction with what the speaker just said.
Right.
And sometimes that's distracting and not to be confrontational,
but to just make it a more open discussion. And
I mean, not to be nasty in any way, there's nothing personal about it. I mean, we all say things sometimes or forget about certain data points or forget about things. I mean, this is just inherent in being what we are, but just to bring that out and maybe allow those kind of discussions a little bit more. And I like the interaction with industry. I felt like a lot of the other societies were so squeamish and so careful about their interactions with industry that there was more of a separation than there should be. Because at least by my generation, what's so obvious to me is that the really big breakthroughs have to be done on the corporate side, because it's very hard for an academic institution, even let alone a solo practitioner, to try to do the type of work you need to do to get a drug to market, for example. I mean, that's got to be done on the industry side. And those guys, you know, everybody's motives are different. And, you know, I think we're all aware of what people's motives are, both as physicians, but definitely if you're working for a corporate entity, we know what those motivations are. But at the end, part of everybody's motives is to make the patient better. And I think that's what we have to keep underlying. We're all really working on the same team to help the patient. Mm-hmm. So those are the things I liked about VBS. I'm sure there's more. But those were among them why I thought it was important to make VBS happen. Now, the second question, and you're privy to a lot of this discussion. You know that we've had years and years of discussion about how to keep VBS young, because we thought of it originally as an organization for young vitreoretinal surgeons. The way that we finally come to grips doing it, I mean, I had an idea that the original idea that I had, and I think most people on the board bought into, was that at the 10-year mark, we would just stop being on the board and there would be a new board and it would either continue or we'd just be done. That was it. And we'd stop. But then as time went on, people didn't want to give up. And then there was the argument, which I think is valid, you know, that if we just turn it over to a bunch of people who don't really know the organization, they might have a really tough time pushing it forward. They might not care enough about it or have the same vision that we did. So now we have this system where we're bringing in new people, you and Yoshi, for example, on the scientific program committee, and Murnali and Anton Orlin is now taking over the treasury of the organization. But more and more, each of us that we're doing a part of the job are trying to bring in a younger person to work that area. And I think it's amazing because I love you. You didn't make it to the board meeting that we had, but we just had a board meeting recently, and it's great now just to sit back and, you know, chime in occasionally when I have something that I think is useful to say. But for the most part, you know, trying to get the younger folks to take over and really drive their what their interests are and so forth. And I think it's great because the organization does have you know, some financial resources and a whole bunch of networking resources in terms of the relationships we've built over the years, to where somebody could walk in and really make use of that in a good way.
You've been in Miami now a number of years.
Yeah.
You know, you're a professor, so you're a senior faculty, mm-hmm. whether or not you want to admit mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm.
I've already won the Senior Achievement Award for the AAO and the Senior Honor Award for the ASRS. So, yeah, somebody's telling me that I should think about retirement. But
I mean, you've seen... How did you end up here?
How did I end up in Miami?
Yeah. You have no connection. We talked about Buffalo, Baltimore, Princeton, Houston, L.A. Miami's never on the radar. So, obviously, basketball...
It was triangular. Place, but... I mean, it happened. I did have some idea that this might happen, as I remember distinctly talking to one of my roommates in med school. So, the main driving thing was that my wife Frances, who's my lovely wife Frances, who's a medical oncologist here at Sylvester at University of Miami. We started dating first year of medical school, so that relationship got pretty serious by the time we were applying for residencies. And I think at that point, she wanted to do internal medicine. I was going into ophthalmology. There wasn't a couples match. That was one of the reasons we chose L.A., because there were so many programs where things might work out for us. And so we wound up there. But anyway, she was from Miami, and she really strongly wanted to come back to Miami. And I had heard of this place, Bascom Palmer. I heard it wasn't quite as good as Wilmer. But but it had some reasonable people, mm-hmm. and I'd heard that this was a good place to do academics. I wanted to do academics, and I remember my roommate from medical school pulled me aside once. We were at some sort of party, and he said, "Listen, he goes, this is all going to work out for you. He goes, you're going to be the ocular immunology guy at Bascom Palmer." And I said, you know, shut up, that's not going to happen. But he called it. That's what wound up happening ultimately with uveitis. So it was Francis being here, and then the other component of it that happened was that Ron Smith, who was the chairman at Doheny when I was there, was a cornea and uveitis specialist, one of the founders of the American Uveitis Society. He, you know, I was in clinic with him and as part of as a uveitis fellow. And he was chairman, so he was always doing, you know, 10 things at once. And he had just finished coming out of a room with a patient. He said, come here, come talk to me for a second. I'm going to make your career. I remember he said that. And then we walked into the room, and he said, I just saw this email on, I think it was like a American Uveitis Society post. And he said, Janet Davis is looking for a partner, and I think you'd be perfect for this job. He goes, I really think, you know, after you do your retina fellowship, because he knew that I was going to do uveitis and then 2 years of retina. He said, this will be great for you. And so that was what pointed me towards Miami. And then that all worked out. You know, I mean, I met Carmen. That was a very colorful experience. Dr. Pugliafito. Yeah. And interviewing for the job. And I got lucky in the sense that they were hiring more retina specialists because of the newly built satellite in Palm Beach. Mm. So that was, I think that was part of the impetus for you know, having the space to accommodate me. Because I didn't really take over anybody's practice. I started here.
De novo.
De novo. Without, like, you know, seeing like 5 patients a day for a while. And then that slowly built up. And I started up at the same time as Andrew Moshfeghi. So he was in Palm Beach, and I was mostly down here in Miami, but I'd go up there. And so that was, you know, that was both of us kind of getting our feet wet with clinical practice and everything at the same time. That was a good experience going forward.
You referenced your wife's an oncologist. You travel, obviously, a lot for work.
Yeah.
She's very busy with her own career. You have three kids, one in college, two growing up.
Yes.
I mean, a lot of people listening are early attendings fellows. They're starting their families. They're starting their careers. And balance is a big thing that they talk about, right?
Yeah.
How do you balance all this? I mean, you get an invitation to do something. You have soccer game for your kids. You told me recently to go to a soccer game, come back. I mean, these are all choices every single day that you have to make. How do you guys manage that? You know, and a lot more people now are two physician or two working parent households.
Yeah. The only advice I can give is talk to your spouse a lot. I think the times when it messes up is when there hasn't been enough communication back and forth, and that's tough in a professional family with both two physician families, but. Because there isn't always a lot of time to talk about things. And then when we do have time to talk about things, maybe the last thing we want to talk about is, you know, where I'm going to give a lecture. So, it's tough. And I would be lying if I didn't tell you that the traveling that I do is a constant source of frustration and friction in my marriage. I mean, it may be the most problematic thing. Maybe that's the kind of problem, you know, if that's your worst problem, it's not that bad. But it is interesting. I mean, the traveling component, I didn't really get when I never thought that would be a big part of my job. But when I got hired by Dr. Pugliafito, he told me, he said, listen, you're going to love this job. Yeah, I can tell you're going to have a great time. You're going to work harder than you've ever worked. You think fellowship was hard? This is nothing compared to what the amount of work you're going to do as an attending. He was right about all these things. I mean, he had good insight into all of that. And he said, your one responsibility is to become a world-recognized resource in uveitis. So, and you know, especially as relates to vitreoretinal surgery. He told me, he said, your responsibility is if you get invited to give a talk, you've got to go and give that talk. He said, we will support you. And at those days, Bascom really had an amazing, expense account for these things. That's changed a little bit over the years. But in those days, any time you were invited to speak, it was covered and it was fully supported. I mean, from the chairman on down, that was part of the Bascom-Palmer mission. Was to communicate data and our treatment protocols and what we're doing here to other places. I think it's been a great experience for me. I found out I didn't think I was a very good speaker early on. In fact, I'm pretty sure it was pretty bad. I remember my wife asking me how to go, and I would always say, went horrible. I'm kind of a naturally self-critical person, so when I get off the podium, I remember like the three things I messed up or whatever. But I kept getting invited back to give talks and so forth, and it's a great way to learn. It's a great way to focus your research activities and think about what you want to do forward. And you get to meet all these people that have the same interests as you do, that are doing the same thing in different parts of the world, and you get to see, you know, how do they manage Dusan in Brazil, and talk to the people who are actually there and meet all these things. So, and hear the data that they think is interesting and what they find compelling. And what kind of outcomes they're having. So I think it's a very important part of what I do, and I take it very seriously. But it is hard on the marriage. There's no doubt about it. And so how do I deal with it? I mean, it's balance. You know, I try to. I've started to feel more comfortable with saying no to things.
Mm-hmm.
Recently,
it's hard to say no when you're building your career.
It's very hard because you don't know. You think that if I don't do this, they're not going to ask me again. And it's the opportunity cost of not being there, and you know, making yourself heard, and that's true. That's tough. I think it does get it's very, very tough in the beginning. But on the other hand, I've always been my philosophy about life in general, but you know, my job and so forth, and balance, family and life, sort of work balance, is that you have to keep yourself grounded in what the most important aspects are of what you're doing. And I think you think about yourself as, if you have children, as a parent, yourself as a spouse, as a family member, yourself as a physician, I think, where you're treating patients. Because the travel also does get in the way of treating patients.
Right.
So I hate when a patient has a complication and I'm out of town and I have to ask one of my colleagues to deal with it. Or I can't see somebody through, or I miss a phone call. Somebody's got some horrible problem and I can't talk to them about it. That also bothers me. So those are the things I'd like to think that I've managed to keep those things, as far as work goes, particularly patient care, as the as the number one focus that always take the top. If there's a patient care related issue and there's a research issue, I choose the patient care related issue first over the, over the research issue every time. And that helps. And then the family thing too, you know, we've had, without going into any details, but we've had some health crises in my immediate family over the years. And thankfully so far, not any for me, but for close family members. And I've had to bag on meetings to help people out in situations. And I hate doing that. It goes against, I was brought up to think that if you say you're going to do something and then you don't do it, that's like the worst thing ever. So I hate that, but it's happened to me a couple times, and I apologize to those that I've bagged on. But yeah, sometimes you have to keep some balance there, and you have to make a decision. You know, this is bad enough. This I'm needed at home. I gotta skip this meeting, and you just gotta do it. I think you're right. It gets easier as you get older, because you know that the invitations are still going to keep coming.
Right.
But I think, you know, even when you're starting out, I think it's good to have some balance and know when to say no.
I've eaten up a lot of your time, and we're getting close to your cereal line.
I'm gonna talk forever.
I have two short questions for you.
Okay.
The first question, because we have to talk about uveitis a little bit. You talked about the ripping your hair out part of uveitis. You know, we have people, and I get this question from residents a lot. They're like, I'm interested in a career in retina and uveitis, right?
Yeah.
So the two questions I get are most common. One is, does it matter if you do your uveitis training first or second? And two is, how do you balance that when you go in the real world? Because unfortunately, as we move into more of a compensation-driven model, whether it's private practice or academics, you aren't necessarily rewarded for spending 45 minutes with your uveitis patient going over immunomodulating therapy, going over their anti-metabolites. These are complicated patients that take time, and not all models equally support that. And that's a question I do get from people, is like, how do I ensure that I can kind of have this career and take care of these complicated patients but not be penalized for doing this? Any advice from your standpoint, anything you've seen talking to colleagues?
First of all, I don't think that it's a crucial decision about which you do first, retina or uveitis. I think I've seen folks do it in either order. I did uveitis first. I think that I brought a lot to my retina fellowship, especially because at Baylor there really wasn't a 100% focused person on uveitis. So the retina team was doing most of the uveitis, and most of them, you know, that wasn't a major interest that they had. So so I brought a lot to the table as a fellow to Baylor from the experience that I had at Doheny with uveitis. So that worked out okay. I think I've had fellows like Ephraim Mendelkorn, who's in Toronto. He did retina first and then came here and did uveitis. And that was fantastic, maybe better than the way I did it, just because he was able to participate in the surgical management of these patients,
right,
to do the diagnostic vitrectomies, to take care of, you know, macular holes, epiretinal membranes, retinal detachments in these patients, and so that added something to his practice too. Now, how do you deal with the fact that uveitis does not make as much money as retina? You can merge them. So I still like about some 40% at least, if maybe 50% of my practice is still retina. I still do retinal detachments. I love retinal detachments. I still do macular holes, epiretinal membranes, and so forth as they come in. So I try to keep my skill set alive in retina. I see a lot. I see diabetics. I see macular degeneration, and so forth. So I think you soften the difference there by seeing some. Now, I do probably half the number of injections as my colleagues do per clinic, and that's, you know, that's obvious why that is. And I do different sorts of injections. I probably do way more ganciclovir injections than, you know, anybody besides Janet. So they're different sorts of things. But you have to ask yourself, I think at the end of the day, there are some people that have been able to make a uveitis practice as productive as a retina practice. But for most people, that's not true. Your uveitis patients are going to take more time. And by virtue of taking more time, you're not going to see as many patients. And I, you know, I noticed my good friend, Jorge Fortune. We've recently started one of the techs at Palm Beach, started this thing where she she clips as many patients, like let's say we got 52 patients. Like yesterday, I think we had a similar number. He might have had a few more than me. Yesterday I only had 37. That's right. And he had like 50 patients. Okay. And so she puts paper clips. She makes a little chain of paper clips for each patient. So as we go down, she takes off the paper clip. So we can see in real time how fast we're doing. And it is embarrassing how much faster Jorge is. Okay. So it is true, but I've got, especially in Palm Beach, all these uveitis patients from North Florida, from everything north of Palm Beach in Florida. These are complicated patients. I have to talk to them. I mean, it's different from seeing an AMD patient for the 100th time and giving them their, 97th Eylea injection. So it slows you down, and that translates into... also, the other thing is, by virtue of being, fairly well known as a guy that can help you out with the uveitis patients, I don't get a lot of surgical referrals. And so my surgical base is also a little bit different than guys who are really trying to get the surgical referrals. But that may have some impact. But you just have to make a decision about what you're comfortable with, I certainly don't think that I'm that it's hurting me that much. I love what I do, but it is a love that I have for this particular disease set that comes from the fellowship training that I had, and now from what I've done for 12 years and research and what I know about it. I do love the field. But I know it's an opportunity cost. Could I just decide tomorrow I'm going to change completely and go into general retina and probably make more money? Maybe, but I definitely would not be as happy as I am now doing what I do.
Last question. We got a minute.
Okay.
You saw the ESPN 30-30 about the Bills?
Yeah, I did.
How did it make you feel? Was it nostalgia? You're happy about it? How do Buffalo people feel about those Bills teams in retrospect? Proud? Disappointed?
No, proud, I think. That was a great time, That was a great time for football in Buffalo. It was great to see Buffalo doing so well nationwide and being at the forefront of everybody's thought, when it came to football with four back-to-back Super Bowls.
And they weren't favored in any of those, I think. Maybe one they were favored.
But yeah, it was a weird time where they weren't the better team. So much better than the AFC at that time for whatever reasons. I'm not smart enough to know why, but whatever it was. But it was bad. But, the playoff games were great getting to that point. And it was great being in the Super Bowl, and there was always hope. Every year that we went, I'd hope for the next year. In fact, I doubled down on all my bets. So those were the 4 years that Buffalo went to back-to-back Super Bowls were the years I was in college, and every year I bet on them. And every year I lost, obviously. But I doubled my bet every year going forward. So I lost like a maximum amount, thinking that I would win back everything.
That's amazing.
When they won. And I totally misplayed that. It didn't work out for me at all. But any event, yeah, I think but we're nostalgic about that. And the thing is, that's interesting, is I've remained a Bills fan for my entire career. And my son is a Bills fan. In fact, he's a bigger Bills fan now than I am. He certainly follows things a lot closer than I do. And I told him, it's been, so the last time the Bills were in the playoffs before this recent year was 1999, I think. And so at that point, I was like, I really just got to stop. Because it's just too much disappointment. And I'm like, maybe I should just not watch football anymore. Just give it up. And then this year, the Bills are doing well again. And Josh Allen looks amazing. And they got, Singletary and all. I'm just sucked right back in. So now I'm watching them again. And we'll see what happens this year. But it looks like there's been a new breath of life in the team. So we'll see.
Thanks so much for your time. And thank you for joining us. Listeners are going to appreciate this.
Yeah, thanks so much. Hope it works. Take care.
See you.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. It's RETINAPodcast.com. All 203, yes, we have 203 episodes, can be found there sorted by category. You can also find our blog, Equal, Round, and Reactive, Lessons for Our Pupils, on our website. Remember, you can now claim CME credits for selected podcast episodes via the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. Simply log in as an AAO member and visit the link in the episode description. Our website has links to sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. That's really the best way to get know when these episodes come out. You can also subscribe directly on your mobile device in the Apple Podcasts or Android Store, and that will give you push notifications as well. We are on Twitter at Retina Podcast. You can contact us there or by clicking on the link on our website or emailing us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We love getting feedback on things we can do better and things we're already doing well. And we appreciate everyone who continues to leave positive reviews in the Apple Store. Many thanks to Dr. Thomas Albini for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Angela Chang, and Dr. Michael Venacasa for preparing this episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.